I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
The recent Dublin International Film Festival, I had the distinct pleasure of sitting down with Antonia Campbell-Hughes and Ivan Kavanagh to discuss their new film, The Canal, which is out in cinemas today. Here is that interview.
It's the mix of visuals and sound is really unsettling.
That's what we're after.
I really like the use of the archive-y type footage. Did you have that, or did you shoot that yourself?
Yeah, no, we shot it ourselves. We recreated the old films using a hand crank camera from 19.
Okay.
We tried every other film stock. We tried type of camera. We used 16mm, 8mm, all types, and we couldn't recreate the look that we wanted. So by pure chance, I found this guy online. He's a collector of old cameras, and we contacted him, and he flew over with the camera from the UK. And he said it had been used in the trenches during the First World War.
Wow.
And he wasn't sure whether it worked, because it was in storage since then, but it was pristine inside. It was beautiful. So me and Pierce ran the 35mm footage through it, and we got it back from the lab, and it just looked stunning. It was just ghostly and beautiful, and it flickered exactly the same as those old films.
Yeah, it's very, got a very ethereal feel to it, ethereal feel to it. And plus, then I loved how halfway through it, suddenly there's like bright red, and then, you know.
flashes the colour,
Yeah,
I love that in films. I remember I saw Black Narcissus, the Pell and Pressburger film about the nuns in the Himalayas, and there's an amazing moment in that where one of the women faints, the nuns faints. And she's just fainting, and there's this flash to red. And it always stayed with me. It was just really expressionistic way of using colour, and not realistic at all. But why should you? Because it's a movie, you know?
And
something that's cinematic for its own sake, you know? It's self-consciously cinematic.
Yeah, like Spielberg in Schindler's List as well.
He does that too, yeah. With the red girl with the red coat.
Yeah, so it's just... Yeah. There's lots of nods to old cinema throughout, it's nice. Plus, it's very modern looking in the way it's shot. The cinematography, the Pierce McGrail's stuff is exceptional.
Me and Pierce talked for months before about the look of the film. You know, I storyboarded a lot of it, and we chose the angles very carefully. Every shot was thought out. There's not one shot in there that's superfluous. You know, everything is essential. And sometimes some of the scenes are shot with just one shot, you know, in one continuous take.
How did you get the one towards the end with in the water?
Oh, underwater?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, we did that in a swimming pool.
Okay.
It was a pretty arduous day. That was a full day's shooting, and we didn't think we were going to get it. We had very little time. But we got it in the end, and then in the grey, that's when it really came together, you know.
You put that light source in it?
No, the light source was already there. We just heightened it and changed the colours and darkened other areas. But, if you ever shot underwater, you know how difficult it is, you know.
Yeah, James Cameron talks very badly about it during Titanic when he's trying all done.
We had a lot more money than we had, I think, you know.
That's okay. Well, you had a lot more money around this time around than you had the last time.
That's true. Horror. I made Tin Can Man for about €500.
Really?
So, I don't know how much it was exactly, because it was only a few sandwiches and transport, you know. So maybe it was 200, I don't know. But,
keep lowering it. The better.
For nothing,
there you go.
But it was only a crew of two, and I recorded the sound, and I spent months in my little bedroom doing the sound design. But what fun it was, you know. It was great.
And it recently came out in the US, but we haven't had a chance to get it here.
It'll be here soon, I think, and in Europe, you know.
Because
it did quite well in the US, and it's kind of film that has. I made a film straight after it, so I didn't have time to send it out anywhere. So I sent it to about two festivals, and it just went on from there, and it took on a life of its own. And not a month goes by when I don't get contacted by a couple of people about it, you know, wanting to see it or said they've seen it. And it seems to stay with people, you know. I think it's maybe the dream-like quality of it as well. And a few film professors in America have lectured about it as well.
Really?
Yeah, it's really funny, and it's funny to... I didn't think about it at the time. And what they lecture about is that one guy told me that he's never seen a film where half of the film is two guys talking in a room and it's two close-ups. And he says, in film school, when you're doing that, you'd be told you can't have half a film with two people talking in a room because it's not cinematic. But I didn't think about that at the time. It was just, well, this feels right, so you just go with it, you know.
And Tarantino said there's no such thing as what is and isn't cinematic.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. And I didn't go up to film school, so.
Yeah, so similar type of education then as he had, you know, watching.
What feels right, so go with your instincts, I think it's always the best. Yeah.
And how did you get involved in it? I'm wary that he's talking an awful lot.
No, thank you. But that is, I'm a bystander and the genius that is. But yeah, I don't know. I recall I was in Dublin, I think, for a week or something, and I got a call from my agent, and so Ivan and I met here, weirdly, and Ivan said, why are we meeting here? but it was kind of a meeting, we discussed the project quite a lot, didn't we? Yeah. And we tried to see if there was a way that I could fit in. So it wasn't an obvious fit to any one of the characters specifically. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we talked, I think Ivan maybe knew a little bit of my work, and I had a lot of respect for him. And so that's how it kind of came about.
Your character is kind of the last anchor that David has to the real world, because he's slowly going absolutely insane.
That's why I was really fascinated by her, because the one note that that Ivan always said to me was that she has this sort of blind love. It's just love. It's like a goodness. It's almost quite, you know,
the purity.
It's eternal. Yeah. It's like to really look after him and cherish him. And I suppose that was nothing that I had ever played before, and that really appealed to me. And it's also, I think, because you know, the film is very much David's journey and what's going on in his psychology.
Yeah.
And it's quite nice to, for me, because I a lot of the films I've done up to that point have been leads, so I really enjoyed the process of having this one personal character journey that is sort of like a sideline. You know, it's not core to the plot, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but you can still bring a depth to.
Yeah,
to
because that is what is so important about David's process, is that there are these women that surround him, and they all are components of the ideal perfect woman for him.
It's like a dream. It's like wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
They all fill a specific role that he wants in his life after he finds out about his wife. You know, his Antonio's character is someone who listens to him and understands him and wants him.
Yeah, and it also seems to go against her better judgment. Like, if people are coming from walls and you're talking to a guy who's losing it, get out.
Yeah. But she wishes. She's got this ideal. It's almost like, you know, she probably goes home at night and imagines that they are this. His feelings are mutual, but, you know, she plays out fantasy in her existence, and that's why she's not as reticent to see his crumbling.
So they're both dreamers, but in different kind of ways.
Yes. Mm. And who's in what dream, or whose dream? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's almost impossible to follow if what you're seeing is actually happening to him, or he's just going mental.
I love films like that where you're not sure with the ambiguity of what is real and what isn't, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's many different interpretations I've heard about what happens at the end, and I love that. I love people discussing or debating a film.
Well, that's it. I mean, to mention a lot of it is to spoil a lot of it. So if you've, after the fact that you've seen it, the people talking from gaps in walls is...
Yeah.
Is the kid seeing this? What's it going on?
Exactly.
It's now, has the kid gone insane? The haunted house films are brilliant in that sort of
respect. You can go anywhere with it. It can be as surrealistic as you want, you know?
Sorry.
I don't think it's any coincidence that a lot of quite experimental filmmakers experimented with horror films, you know?
Yeah.
Carol Dreyer was...
Thank you very much.
Well, I suppose you cited De Palma as one of your influences and stuff first.
I love De Palma, early De Palma especially, you know.
Yeah.
He's an underrated director, I think. He's made some maverick films, but when he's
on form, he's
amazing. And one I always loved was, when I first saw it, was Raising Cain. I think it's a great film, you know.
No, it is.
It's so experimental, the structure of it and the way he messes with the audience, you know, and he's having fun with the genre, you know.
It's good. It's good to see. And it's got, this film has elements of lots of different, like, homages to lots of different horrors. I mean, with that wall scene is kind of Ring-esque, and then you have There's a Twin Peaks vibe to it too. There's a Lynchian vibe to it anyway. Maybe.
Well, so we talked about the cement garden a bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was in relation to this, but what was really interesting is because for the canal, there are actors from so many different places.
Mm.
You know, there's that really nice kind of, although it is sort of Ireland, it has that nice timeless, placeless feel as well.
Dreamlike as well. Yeah. Yeah, where you're not sure where you are exactly.
I wasn't sure where I was. Yeah. Apart from at the very start when I was definitely in an omniplex. After that...
That's what it was after. It was after the fact, okay, I think I'm grounded now in this scene somewhere.
Yeah.
But then you're not sure when the next scene, you know, where am I, you know? Yeah. Well, you might be in his head, you know?
Well, that's it. Yeah. How did you find the house? Where is that?
It was a long story. Actually, it was... It was funny, it was one of the first houses we looked at, and I rejected it. I said, no, this is not it. Maybe I just couldn't see it. I said, it's not how I saw it originally. And then we went back to it, and we made it the way I saw it, you know. Quite a long search, actually, for the house. But I had the right space for the camera as well, and it looked interesting when you shot through doorways.
I had the right age to it too. Because immediately you enter the house and you see the round switches on the walls, and you're like, "Yeah, this is an old house."
Exactly. Yeah. And I love Christmas. You know, in films, it instantly makes everything better. You're more cinematic. You know. I think it's been Christmas in three of my films so far.
You're Shane Black of Ireland.
Yeah. I love the lights in the background and the primary colours and Christmas lights.
And if it's in Ireland, the rain over the lights.
Yeah.
You do so nice. Get that sort of eerie type of feel too. Because, I mean, it's points of light in darkness. Yeah. And that's, I mean, to an awful lot of people, other people are points of light in darkness. And so, therefore, you know, you get that kind of... People can start reading into themselves.
That's true, yeah. Also, as well, I saw a horror film when I was a kid as well called Black Christmas.
Oh, yes.
Which looks amazing. It's an amazing looking film, and the way they use the primary colours and that for the lights. And it's a terrifying film as well. It's really great.
Well, that's the thing. If I take anything that's kind of viewed as being safe and inverted, and suddenly you're on edge.
Exactly, yeah.
The concept of going to the cinema should be fine. You know, it's where people go to enjoy and relax, but this guy's getting visions of his house 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's a film archivist is a particularly... unique job for somebody to have in a film. Usually you have a cop or a lawyer or whatever, but a film archivist, it kind of grounds it in the language of cinema.
That's exactly it. And that I thought I could experiment with cinema that way, and I thought all of his references would be from cinema, even his nightmares, you know. And that's why the visual reference are very deliberate, you know. And I should hark back to all early silent cinema, especially, and some of the lighting is quite expressionistic, and the use of colour is very deliberate and cinematic for its own sake, you know.
Yeah, well.
Unapologetically so, I think.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Horror is as old as cinema itself, you know, so people have been making scary stories, and people have been telling scary stories since we invented language. So it's one of the, you know, the cornerstones of how we express ourselves as people. So.
Some of the most cinematic films I've ever seen have been horror films. You know, we talked a lot about The Shining when we first met. How we loved that. You know, and
Dr. Caligari. If you're going back in time, and Mabuse and that sort of
Vampire
stuff.
As well. Yeah. Is another one. And
M.
Oh, M is great.
Which is
it's amazing.
Incredibly unsettling film.
Yeah. I love The Testament of Dr. Mabuse.
Yeah,
I think it's Fritz Lang's masterpiece. It's really that was. Film I looked at a lot before The Canal.
I can see it in it. That's one of the ones that I could see elements of that in it.
And going further on to Don't Look Now as well, which was, especially for colour, was a real reference.
And a lot of the way that you've used Zoom and
the Zooms, Oh, we had great fun with that. Me and Pierce are both fans of Zooms from 70s cinema. You know?
Yeah, it was very much Don't Look Now.
We shot a lot more that we didn't use in the edit. We probably went too far with Zooms, but... we both love Zooms, you know. I think it when video came in, people stopped using them because everyone used Zooms incorrectly, you know.
Yeah.
But, it can be really cinematic, and you just have to look at Kubrick and how he used the Zoom in almost all of his films.
Well, some of the most iconic shots in cinema come with a Zoom of some description, like in Jaws with the pull.
Oh, yeah, the famous one, the Hitchcock shot, the vertigo shot.
Yeah, and the flight in Citizen Kane down and through the glass.
That's right, It's amazing.
I really still don't know how he did that.
Yeah. I think there's a flash, isn't it, of lightning, and that's where the cut
is. That's where they get through the duck. It's an amazing shot.
Yeah, amazing. Purely cinematic.
You're lucky to have Piers, because he has a very keen eye for this sort of stuff. And because yesterday I was talking to Brian O'Malley about Let Us Pray, and that the opening of that is just...
Did Piers shoot that?
Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
He's prolific at all.
He had three this weekend.
Glassland as well.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. I've worked with Piers like three times. Astonishing. Really?
Yeah. There's a lot. Me and Piers hope to work together on the next couple of things I do as well. Hit it off creatively. We had a lot of the same ideas, and great fun working together. So
you have a sort of idea of what that's going to be, or
I'm working on a psychological horror film at the moment, another one, and I'm also working on an American TV series for American Network, English Network.
That's great.
It's an 8-part TV series, and I hope I can get Pierce to shoot that as well if I can.
Excellent. I suppose I better go to keep looking in then.
I don't know.
There's different types. Well, I know there's people waiting outside. So.
Yeah.
I'll call it a day before they come and get me.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.